Welcome to another episode of the Oncology on the Go podcast. I'm your host, Russ Conroy. As part of a Cancer Network Frontline Forum program, various experts reviewed key data updates and real-world practice findings in newly diagnosed multiple myeloma, and how they may impact patient subgroups, including those with transplant-ineligible disease. First, Dr. Giselle Cook of Mayo Clinic and Dr. Matthew James Pianco of the University of Michigan Ann Arbor led one part of the discussion. They discussed efficacy results from studies including the Phase 3 MAIA study, selecting patients with transplant-ineligible multiple myeloma for triplet or doublet regimens as induction therapy, and potential disparities in care for patients of racial and ethnic minorities.
Hello, and thank you for joining this Frontline Forum program titled Transforming Newly Diagnosed Multiple Myeloma, From Real-World Evidence to Clinical Practice. I am Dr. Giselle Cook. I'm a hematologist specializing in the management of patients with multiple myeloma and dyscrotinemias from the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. Joining me today is my esteemed colleague, Dr. Matthew Pianco, and I'd like to invite Dr. Pianco to introduce himself.
Hi, everyone. I'm Matt Pianco. I'm a hematologist at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor. I have a focus in the care of patients with multiple myeloma and other plasma cell disorders. It's a real pleasure to be with you here today. Thank you so much for joining us.
I think one of the big questions was, what are the available treatment options for patients with transplant ineligible newly diagnosed multiple myeloma? And while there are a number of treatment options available, the big two groups of treatment that are commonly selected are bortezomib, lenalidomide, and dexamethasone, and then daratumumab, lenalidomide, and dexamethasone. And if you look at the NCCN guidelines, these are also the category one preferred regimens. Another big question that we discussed was, what is the goal of therapy for these patients? And seeing that this is a transplant ineligible group of patients that we're talking about, I think the big question to answer or to address that former question is, why is a patient transplant ineligible? Is it due to age? Is it due to frailty? Is it due to comorbidities? And we also discussed that chronologic age in and of itself is not an absolute contraindication to transplant, but that's something that has to be considered when we're talking about transplant eligibility and ineligibility and which treatment will be chosen. And so given those considerations, we all agreed that the goal of therapy is really to achieve the deepest response possible, but doing so with minimal toxicity and reducing patients' disease-related symptoms to ultimately improve their quality of life. And so at this point, I'll pivot into the data and the treatment options for transplant-ineligible patients, and I'll ask Dr. Pianco to discuss the latest efficacy results from the MAIA study.
Great, thank you. Care of the transplant-eligible patients very important topic. It's actually probably the majority of patients that we treat end up falling into this category. And I think one of the most practice-changing studies that we've encountered in our field in recent years has been the MAIA trial. So I'd like to touch on the MAIA trial's design and some of the most up-to-date efficacy outcomes from that trial. So the MAIA trial was a randomized phase 3 trial that assigned patients to receive either the triplet of daratumumab, lenalidomide, and dexamethasone, or the doublet of lenalidomide and dexamethasone in newly diagnosed patients. So patients were randomized 1-to-1 to either receive DRD or RD, and patients were treated until time of progression or unacceptable toxicity. And the primary endpoint of this trial was progression-free survival. The trial had about 737 total participants, with 368 and 369 in the DRD and the RD arms, respectively. And they had a relatively well-balanced assignment of characteristics between the arms. So this study recently published some long-term follow-up results with a median long-term follow-up of 64.5 months. We found that the progression-free survival continued to be better in the DRD arms compared with the RD arms, with about 61.9 months in the Dara Revlimid Dex arm compared with about 34.4 months median progression-free survival in the RD arm. This demonstrated overall about a 34% reduction of the risk of death with the use of DARA Revlimid dexamethasone compared with Revlimid dexamethasone. And importantly, this long-term follow-up analysis recently demonstrated there was an overall survival benefit with the use of daratumumab, Revlimid, and dexamethasone with a five-year, with a median overall survival, and actually in the DARA Revlimid dex arm being about not reached a median overall survival versus about 65.5 months in the Revlimid dexamethasone arm. So at about the 60-month marks, about the five-year mark after the initiation of treatment, the median overall survival is about 66% in the DRD arm versus 53.6% in the RD arm. So, you know, overall, I think that in addition to these endpoints of progression-free survival and overall survival, there was also a higher MRD negativity rate, about three times the patients receiving, there was about a threefold increase in MRD negativity in the DRD arm compared with the RD arm, with about almost a third of patients reaching MRD negativity who received the triplet versus about 11% who reached, who were treated with the doublet. And, you know, overall, just looking at this patient population, a significant proportion of these patients were older adults. You know, I think reflecting quite well our transplant ineligible patient population. So in thinking about this, I feel like this study, in contrast to some other studies we've had previously for transplant not preferred or transplant ineligible, you know, myeloma patients, this is largely an older adult patient population, which I think reflects quite nicely the what we see in practice, at least from an age demographics perspective. So, you know, I'd next like to discuss, you know, ask my colleague, Dr. Cook, to discuss how these the Meyer results compare with another important trial, the SWOG SO777 study.
Yeah, I thank you for going through the Maya study in such detail. Another groundbreaking study which really introduced triplets into the landscape was the SWOG 0777 study. And this was a trial of VRD, bortezomib, lenalidomide, and dexamethasone compared to Revlimid and lenalidomide and dexamethasone. And these patients received this as an induction before going on to lenalidomide and dexamethasone maintenance. And so this, while this was a landmark study, which also reported a superior PFS and overall survival with the triplet compared to the doublet. With the triplet, we saw median PFS of about 41 months compared to 29 months for lenalidomide and dexamethasone. And the long-term follow-up of this trial also showed, similar to the Mayo study, that the median overall survival was not reached with bortezomib, lenalidomide, and dexamethasone. But this is an older study. I mean, the patients enrolled on this trial were enrolled between 2008 and 2012. And so while these results are really impressive, seeing that we did not have minimal residual disease data available at that time, we didn't have a ton of cytogenetics at that time. One of the drawbacks of this study, and I think that the Maya kind of takes, you know, has an advantage in that regard, is that the patients on this study were younger than the patients on the Maya study. The oldest patient on the Maya study was 90 years old. And as Dr. Pianco just underscored, you know, this shows that triplets can effectively be used in older patients. And so that's what I really like about the Maya study and comparing the SWOG 077 study. Although, you know, it's not really fair to compare these head to head, seeing that they're happening at two completely different times. And we had a lot more data, a lot more diagnostic advancements by the time we had the Maya study. I think it just underscores that we can use triplets in older patients, but doesn't erase the fact that the bortezomib, lenalidomide, and dexamethasone triplet is a really good triplet that can be used for transplant ineligible or transplant not preferred patients. I'm going to let Dr. Pianco talk a little bit more on selection of patients for doublet versus triplet. I mean, who would you use a doublet on still, and if, you know, all of this data changes anything that you would do?
in terms of the question, like how do we determine who we should treat with a doublet versus who we should treat with a triplet? I mean, the results from the MyoSig study would suggest that really across groups, we should be able to use triplets in frail older adults. I think that I try as best I can to, you know, put those principles into use in my practice. I have octogenarians and nonagenarians who I've been able to treat with triplets for who've done a good job. Certainly, we try to make some dose adjustments for those patients to try to use lower doses of lenalidomide, try to minimize the doses of steroids that we use. And I think that there's certainly probably a lot of heterogeneity, just even amongst, you know, myeloma specialists and community doctors who treat myeloma patients on how exactly we do that. But I find that, you know, really lower doses of lenalidomide and dexamethasone can be combined with DARA and can be quite well tolerated even in octogenarians, nonagenarians with newly diagnosed myeloma. I think there, of course, you know, clinical trials aren't everything. I think that certainly they're important pieces of information that we have access to. And I think there's some of the, it's reliable standardized information that we can dive into, but I think that, you know, clinical trials are not the real world in all cases. So certainly there are some situations in which, you know, the suitability of a patient to be able to come to the infusion center, I think is certainly, you know, potentially a situation in the real world where we wouldn't see those types of patients in the Maya trial if they're unable to come to infusion. So I think there's some, you know, mobility issues, maybe transportation issues might be a challenge for some particular patients. So I think that in considering patients in whom really we might not be able to do infusion-based therapy, you know, that might be a situation in which I might consider a doublet just from a practical perspective. But I think if we can really try to engage support from a community perspective, try to leverage, try to get engaged patients with resources to try to help wherever we can, getting patients in for transportation. For some of these patients, we might really only have one shot at giving them good myeloma therapy, since, you know, there are other comorbidities that patients can have that can be, you know, serious or life-threatening. You know, we may not have multiple regimens to try in these patients. There's a significant degree of attrition. You know, I'd like to point some real world from, Rafael Fonseca from your institution published some really interesting information looking at some models trying to estimate the amount of attrition between regimens in the frontline setting. And we find that, you know, really there is a significant number of patients who don't make it to second line therapy. And so really we try to put our best foot forward. And if we can try to, you know, get the myeloma under control as best we can with the best regimen possible and do so in a way that's safe and well tolerated, then I guess we should really try to do that. Yeah. So I think there are some limited scenarios in which I choose a doublet that largely would be scenarios in which I can't overcome barriers to accessing infusion care, I think would be really probably the main one. And there's probably a variety of scenarios that fall under that. I think that overall, my impression of the results you presented is really that a triplet should be a standard of care.
Yeah.
For all newly diagnosed transplant ineligible myeloma patients. And, I think it's really, I think, phenomenal results for that group.
Yeah, that actually brings us to the next big point about, you know, all of this data that we have, and then how does real world evidence actually interplay into clinical practice? And how do we basically move to suit? Like, how do we adjust these regimens for these transplant ineligible patients? And I totally hit all of those points just a little while ago. Just, you know, we have to accommodate for patients who don't meet strict eligibility criteria. The real world data and the real world experience, which translates into publication, really helps you to know how to guide and adapt, modify treatments for patients. And we're talking about triplets. We know that they're great. We know that they're effective in older patients. And as you said, sometimes you have to do a doublet based on comorbidity. Sometimes you have to drop a drug and continue with a doublet due to tolerance. On the flip side, I would sometimes do a quad in someone who is a fit elderly transplant ineligible patient. So, you know, in clinic, it really is quite dynamic. And clinical trials are, you know, fundamental, but in real world, things are just absolutely not the same, and you have to be flexible.
I think that's like a really key point, and it's you know, part of the nuance that we deal with, practically speaking. Like, you know, every day we're in the clinic. So I think we, you know, the real world is where the rubber meets the road, and we've got to sort of modify our treatments to best suit our patients. And I think, you know, this is a good place where real world evidence can try to help address, you know, some of these questions. So we do our best to get data from clinical trials, but, you know, I think that there's certainly a huge potential application for real world data to understand the, you know, kind of the what are the potential systems impacts of the treatments that we do. What are, you know, if patients do discontinue therapy, you know, we could look at real world data sets to try to understand, you know, medication utilization and try to interpret when patients start their next line of therapy. You know, there are lots of interesting questions that I think we can look at and only really answer through real world data that cannot be answered from prospective clinical trials. You know, outcomes questions and for all the many of our patients who don't meet eligibility criteria, as you said, Dr. Cook, I mean, you know, there's a big segment of our population that you know, we can't really, you know, that aren't clinical trial patients that wouldn't have been in any of these trials. And we have to kind of learn, you know, how to treat our special populations.
With that, we're going to move to unmet needs for transplant ineligible patients. Where do you think that we can move research to help address some of these unmet needs?
So I think that, you know, one of the great things about, you know, working in myeloma as a field is that, you know, we've had so much change and so many new, you know, treatments that have come through in the last, you know, 15, 20 years that have really changed the paradigm for treatment of myeloma. And I think that continues to be the case. So I think that there are novel agents that can improve upon, you know, what we have today, you know, alternate types of drugs, such as the CELMoDs, you know, might be another, you know, type of drug that could, you know, potentially be better than some of the IMiD drugs like lenalidomide or pomalidomide. So if those have potentially a better balance of efficacy and safety, you know, that would be, I think, remains to be seen, but I think is a, you know, interesting thing worth studying. I think certainly novel immunotherapies are a really exciting area. Ways that we can engage our immune system, our T cells, to try to leverage their ability to kill myeloma cells. I think it's been something that's really interesting. So chimeric antigen receptors, T cells or CAR T cells, I think are a really exciting development in the field that I think offers, I think, a lot of promise. I think that T cell redirection in the form of bispecific antibodies is another really exciting area. We've had a novel bispecific antibody drug, teclistamab, recently approved, that's been in practice. So we're getting a lot more tools, I think, to engage the immune system in our work against myeloma. And I think that, you know, trying to figure out how we put all these new tools together in a way that is as safe for the patients, as effective, in what order, sequencing of how, like, which drugs we choose and when, is like a very complicated and very new area that we're going to have to try to work a lot to figure out is, what makes sense to try to get patients to CAR T cells? Would we try to use bispecific antibodies before or after CAR T cells? How can we best, you know, try to optimize the effect of CAR T cells and other new drugs that are going to be coming? I mean, I think it's just a really fascinating part about working in the myeloma field is trying to put all this together.
I agree. I am really excited to see what's going to happen in the next few years. I mean, even in the past 3 or 4 years, there's been such an explosion of new things on the scene. Another thing that I think is super interesting and that I'd like to see is, how is frailty assessment going to change? It's pretty subjective, you know, even as it is with all of these composite scores. But I'm interested to see how radiology and evaluation of sarcopenia, there's new photon counting detector CTs, and all of these new imaging modalities that can assess what is sarcopenia, how does that equate to frailty, and what are some of the biologic markers of senescence, and how that kind of plays into assessment of frailty for transplant ineligible multiple myeloma. I think that would be really something fascinating to look forward to.
You know, I think, you know, just like switching gears a little bit, you know, could you describe what's known regarding disparities in care for multiple myeloma patients and patients who are of racial and ethnic minorities with myeloma?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, just want to preface by saying it's awesome that, you know, we have all of these strides that you just discussed with novel therapies at myeloma, the BiTEs and the CAR-Ts, and getting those involved in earlier lines of therapy. And still, we still have huge disparities in healthcare. We know that Black people are twice to three times more likely to develop multiple myeloma, and they're still not able to access clinical trials, be it due to socioeconomic status, be it due to location or proximity to academic centers. Still, we see that Black patients are less likely to get triplets, less likely to get transplants. And so that's really, that's an area of unmet need. And I really want to see clinical trials becoming more inclusive, becoming more patient-centric. We need trials to accommodate patients who are working, people who are unmarried and unpartnered. We need to do more to understand the biologic drivers in Black patients. Why is it more common? Does that affect outcomes? How does this interplay into responses? And so even though we have all of this like explosion of therapies onto the scene, we still have so much to do to make access to these novel treatments accessible and more equitable for everyone. So lots to do there and lots happening. I guess a lot to see in the next few months to years. And so this has been extremely informative. Thank you so much, Dr. Pianco, for this insightful discussion. And thank you to our audience for watching this Cancer Network program on transplant ineligible newly diagnosed multiple myeloma. We hope you found this discussion to be useful, informative, and as fun as we thought this was. Thank you.
Thank you, everyone. Thank you, Dr. Cook.
Thank you.
Next, Dr. Luciano Costa of the University of Alabama at Birmingham and Dr. Timothy Schmidt of the University of Wisconsin provided their perspectives in the multiple myeloma space. They reviewed topics such as findings from the Phase 2 Griffin trial and discussed how to approach consolidation and maintenance therapy for patients with transplant-ineligible multiple myeloma.
Hello, and thank you for joining the Cancer Network Frontline Forum program titled Transforming Newly Diagnosed Multiple Myeloma from Real-World Evidence to Clinical Practice. I'm Luciano Costa. I'm a professor of medicine and director of the Multiple Myeloma Program at the University of Alabama at Birmingham. Joining me today is my esteemed colleague, Dr. Timothy Smith. I would like to invite Dr. Smith to introduce himself.
I'm Tim Schmidt. I am an assistant professor at the University of Wisconsin and emerging myeloma specialist here in Wisconsin. Luciano, you've done a lot of work in this area, with the particularly the master study. So if you could explain to people, the study design and the results of the master study that evaluated Dara KRD, then with that MRD response adapted therapy, I think that what an interesting trial. And
absolutely. Thanks. And thanks, team, for asking. Thanks for being part of that effort as well. So as you know, that is a trial that used Dara KRD on a population that, it's transplant eligible by definition because transplant was part of the therapy, but it's not the typical transplant eligible that you see in most trials, which is defined by age up to 70. We have patients, we didn't have an upper age limit, so we had patients up to the age of 78. There was a deliberate enrichment for high-risk chromosome abnormalities, so we could learn more about those patients who are often underrepresented in clinical trials. And patients who presented very sick to be on a trial could receive one cycle, for example, VCD, get better, then go on study. So we capture a very high-risk population throughout. And I think the easiest first message is that the regimen is pretty effective, not surprising, with near 100% response rate and and actually quite safe. We did not see a disproportional amount of cardiovascular event, which is always a concern when we use carfilzomib. And of course, very little in the ways of neuropathy because we didn't use bortezomib. But this trial, had four cycles of Dara KRD transplant. And then beyond transplant, what we did was an MRD-adapted approach where patients who had MRD negativity in two consecutive occasions discontinued therapy. And patients who did not continue to receive DARA-KRD for up to 8 cycles. And if at some point they reached 2 MRD negativities 4 months apart, a day of treatment was discontinued. So what we learned from that study is, that approach first is feasible. We could do a real-time MRD in 97% of the patients. The response rates are very high, over 80%, over 80%, close to 80% complete response rate. And MRD negativity of 81%, which is the highest reported, even though we had a bunch of high-risk patients. When we look at how those people do long-term, and we're about to update this data at EHA in the next coming days, what you see is that about 70% of the patients were able to discontinue therapy. And the patients with 0 to 1 high-risk chromosome abnormality do very well. So they have a very high, now long-term PFS and overall survival, despite the fact that the majority of them are off therapy. But patients with 2+ high-risk abnormalities, which in real practice, they're about 10 to 15% of the patients. We're now called an ultra-high risk. In this trial, deliberately, we had had more due to our enrichment strategy. They don't do very well. And it's not that they don't do very well because treatment was interrupted. They don't do very well, period. A lot of the failures happen even while patients are still receiving quadruple therapy. And that has been seen in other trials where people have received continuous therapy with doublets or even with, IMiD PI doublets or IMiD CD38. So it's becoming, I think, more clear in this field that as we improve the upfront therapy, okay, and incorporate quadruplets, maybe the divider is not between standard risk and high risk anymore. The divider is between those ultra high risk patients that's going to need something very new, very early, to at least try to get better versus everybody else. So it's good news for everybody else that now, patients with 414 or even isolated 17P, they seem to behave like standard risk, which is great. But those ultra high risk patients, I think that kind of allows us to focus on those patients for future endeavors. Tim, one thing that, as you recall, because you were a very active part of that, was that because we had patients over the age of 70, we had this kind of unique opportunity to observe quadruple therapy followed by transplant in patients age 70 and more. So can you comment on that?
Yeah, so I was a part of this analysis that was led by one of your colleagues, Smith Geary, looking at the outcomes of the patients in MASTER who were over the age of 70. So a population that for many transplant myeloma trials would not have been eligible just based on their age. I thought that was very innovative that MASTER included these patients. And so what we found was that older patients who were still thought to be transplant eligible, more based on, on fitness rather than chronological age, that they still benefited from this approach, that patients could still receive their therapies. They had responses. The response depth, I believe, was just a tiny touch, maybe a little bit lower rate of MRD negativity, but still it was a strategy that was able to induce deep and durable responses in many of these patients who were over the age of 70. I thought that it was really impactful that this study that's led to the highest depth of response, yet reported in this population was something that was feasible in our elderly patients who were fit for transplant. And so I think that this just kind of goes to show that patients shouldn't just be told that they're not eligible for transplant just because they are older, that we really should be trying to include these patients in clinical trials that are aimed at, delivering some of these innovative new therapies, as well as, consideration of transplant, even when a trial is not there. Another study very, similar in design with quadruplet therapy was the Griffin study. And so could you discuss kind of the final analysis of the Griffin study that it looked at DARA RVD in those kind of clinically relevant subgroups?
Yeah. So that's a very relevant study for our practice. As you know, the largest study, phase 3, that gives robust evidence for upfront quadruple therapy in multiple myeloma is the Cassiopeia study that was done in Europe with VTD added daratumumab, transplant VTD plus daratumumab, and either no maintenance or dara maintenance. So that study is sends a very strong message, but that was in the US was perceived as not immediately relevant because for the longest time, the standard in the US had been RVD with a different, of course, immunomodulatory agent. So the Griffin study was a randomized phase two with a little bit over 100 patients in each arm that addressed that question, you know, can we take the US standard, which is RVD transplant maintenance lenalidomide, add the CD38 monoclonal antibody to it, and see if we get improved results. And at the time, the primary endpoint was stringent CR. And what we learned on that study was that, first, that regimen is very well tolerated. The patients are more likely, not surprisingly, to achieve a stringent CR with a quadruplet than they were with the triplet. That trial had several secondary endpoints that over time have matured. And one of them is minimal residual disease, which is allow us to give a kind of a deeper look into the efficacy of this quadruplet. And you see that at any given time, you have a higher proportions of patients achieving MRD negativity with quadruplet than you do with triplet. And interesting enough, there was not a randomization on the maintenance. So if your patients started with Dara, they continue with Dara-R, and you see the deepening of MRD negativity at a higher rate, even on the patients with Dara-R versus R, telling us that we really quite don't know yet the optimal duration of the monoclonal antibody in transplant eligible patient. The most recent update of that study, which is, I think, something that a lot of us were looking forward to, is progression-free survival. It was not a primary endpoint of this study. It was a secondary endpoint. As you can imagine, you know, patients can do very well with RVD, you know, and R alone. So it took a while for this trial to mature. But nevertheless, there's now a statistically significant difference in PFS favoring the quadruplet arm. And I think we have seen that over the years, this regimen getting a broader and broader adoption as the de facto standard of care for newly diagnosed multiple myeloma patients who are considered candidates for transplant. Our colleague, Dr. Rebecca Silberman from Oregon Health Sciences University, recently presented the patient-reported outcomes, which is important, right? You know, we know the numbers look better, but do the patients feel better? And what you see is an improvement in patient-reported outcomes over time with therapy, which is not surprising. But that improvement is of a greater magnitude on the patients who receive the most efficacious regimen, which in this case is the quadruple. So that's also kind of very reassuring to see.
Absolutely.
You know, Smith, now, sorry, let's go back. Tim, given the available data, how do you select patients with transplant eligible patients with newly diagnosed myeloma among those different regimens? You have now Dara VRD, Dara KRD. There's some data for ESA VRD. We just saw at ASCO data for ELO KRD, right? So how do you pick and choose among that broader portfolio of options?
Right. I mean, it is getting a little bit, you know, more crowded. There are several options that we can choose from here. I would say that certainly the data is much more robust for CD38 antibodies compared to elotuzumab. That data is just emerging. So generally speaking, for transplant eligible patients, almost all of these patients, I am using a quadruplet therapy. And typically I am using bortezomib as the proteasome inhibitor. The reason for that is, I think just primary, it actually comes from a non-transplant study, Endurance, which, you know, didn't actually use transplant, but showed, at least in terms of the primary endpoint, equivalent progression-free survival between carfilzomib and bortezomib. And so based on that, I have gone to bortezomib as the proteasome inhibitor in use with this combination. But for patients with really bad peripheral neuropathy at the beginning of therapy, or somebody who I'm particularly worried about that, I do think that it would be very reasonable in certain circumstances to switch the bortezomib to carfilzomib to continue with that quadruplet therapy for these newly diagnosed transplant eligible patients. I think isatuximab is an interesting, you know, addition to this arsenal here. And I will say the data coming out for isatuximab in newly diagnosed myeloma also appears very, very good. The GMM or the HD7 study looking at ESA VRD that was primarily done in Europe, they have very good rates of MRD negativity in the isatuximab arm. We're still waiting for some of the long-term data from that study to read out. I think that, you know, in choosing one or the other, I mean, regulatory, you know, has something to do with the fact that that is not quite used as much, but also the IV versus subcutaneous administration with daratumumab being available today as subcutaneous, that is typically what I use in the newly diagnosed setting, but there are certainly multiple good options. All right, so Luciano, for patients with transplant eligible myeloma, what is your approach to consolidation and maintenance therapy?
So that's a great question and a hard one, Tim. As you know, I think the path that we start is a bit more clear than the path that we continue, right? And the data is as confusing as it gets, because as we learn on a very strong message on the Cassiopeia trial, you know, what you do in induction and consolidation greatly affects your approach to consolidation to and maintenance therapy. Of course, the de facto standard of care in the U.S., for which we have the best data, we have survival advantage data that's now more than a decade old, is lenalidomide single agent. So I think that is, most of us consider that the standard plan. Now there's several nuances to this, right? I think we have learned very well that patients with high risk chromosome abnormalities don't do very well on that single agent. There's some indirect evidence from retrospective studies that they might do better with the doublets. We just saw at ASCO, Dr. AJ Nuka from Emory present their results with combination of carfilzomib and pomalidomide, looking, you know, somewhat better than you would expect with lenalidomide in a very high risk population. You have, of course, the historical series for Emory with VRD continuing to, I think, for until progression. We have data from the Forte trial, you know, showing that, you know, those patients tend to do better with carfilzomib, lenalidomide versus lenalidomide alone. Perhaps that is more relevant on those high-risk patients. So what I tend to do in our practice is we adapt a little bit to the depth of response. I think the best place to adapt therapy is post-transplant. We tend to continue quadruple therapy for a period of consolidation, particularly if patients remain MRD positive or that's their first MRD negativity. That is a little bit of an uncommon approach. I like to think innovative, but we try to leverage some of the lessons that we learned, for example, on MASTER, and use the quadruplets for a limited period of time before we either, you know, just continue on patients with standard risk disease who have achieved and sustained MRD negative remission or transition to lenalidomide. Now, the most common scenario that we see it in, of course, is somebody who is managed without the information of MRD. We all have those patients in our practice. They're actually the majority of our practice. Patients who got triplets maybe 3-4 years ago, 5 years ago, and they have been on lenalidomide. And the question now is comes up of how long to stay on that. I think when we met this weekend, we talk a lot about the duration of maintenance, which is a question that patients have. And I think the we all discussed the myeloma 11 trial from the UK that was presented last ASH, which is really a randomization between observation and lenalidomide for patients after transplant. And that trial noted that both the MRD status and the duration of maintenance affect the relative benefit of subsequent LAN. So in other words, the longer you go on LAN, the less likely it is that the next year on it is going to be impactful in reducing the risk of progression. And also patients who start MRD negative have a significantly lesser impact than the patients who have MRD positive, which is kind of intuitive, right? More, you know, less disease to improve from. And I use that a lot with my patients. I mean, there's not a black and white answer, what's the optimal duration or how MRD guides that. But, you know, if a patient who's MRD negative and now you have been on maintenance, you know, 2 to 3 years, you can tell the patient there's probably very little benefit of subsequent years. As opposed to somebody who is on the first or second year of maintenance. As you know, those drugs have some of the fatigue and toxicity are cumulative. So I tell patients, don't feel bad if you have to stop after a number of years. That most of the benefit has already been derived from the initial years of therapy, you know? Tim, one other effort that you have been part of and actually was led by your colleague, Dr. Callender, was a recent analysis we made comparing the outcomes of MASTER with Griffin across different risk strata. So I would like you to comment on that and what have we learned from that exercise?
Yes. Yeah. Thank you, Luciano. That I think is a really interesting analysis that was led by Dr. Callender there. So as we've talked a little bit today about the MASTER and the Griffin trials, both of these were using quadruplet CD38 antibody containing regimens with an IMID PI and a steroid. And, you know, this analysis brought together the data and really just kind of compared them side by side of what were the outcomes in terms of progression-free survival, primarily in terms of patients with high-risk cytogenetics. So take a look at the patients who had 0, 1, or 2 or more high-risk cytogenetic abnormalities. And these were defined in this study as translocation 414, translocation 1416, deletion 17P, gain or amplification of 1Q. And then I believe that did MASTER specify 1P as well? It did not. Okay. Well, either way, those were the main cytogenetic abnormalities that were listed as being high risk factors. And so looking at outcomes based on how many of those you had, either 0, 1, or 2. And what was very interesting was that in both studies, for patients who received the quadruplet regimen, patients with 0 or 1 high-risk cytogenetic abnormality had extremely good outcomes. The PFS curves are almost flat with probably 90% or better progression-free survival at 4 years. When they were treated with these CD38 quadruplet antibody combinations plus transplant. However, the group of patients who had 2 or more high-risk cytogenetic abnormalities did not fare quite as well, even with such aggressive therapy. And in both studies, we were seeing a 2-year progression-free survival in the 60 to 65% range. And so, you know, we are having a lot of patients with this ultra high risk category who are experiencing early disease progression in spite of high rates of MRD negativity and in spite of really highly active and effective therapies for newly diagnosed myeloma. And so, I think you can argue that it's this small subset of patients, but it's not a negligible subset of patients. It's probably 10 to 15% or so of newly diagnosed myeloma, where they have two or more high-risk cytogenetic abnormalities. And in spite of everything that we have done, all of these advancements, they're still not doing well enough. And so we really do need to think outside of the box, particularly in this category of patients. And what we're starting to see is a separation there at that ultra high risk level, where some patients with standard risk or just one high risk cytogenetic abnormality are probably going to do well for many years with our current approaches. But we really do need to think about how to help that ultra high risk group earlier before they start to develop refractory disease that is much harder to control.
So Tim, that is excellent. And I think as we wrap up our program, each of us pick one unmet need that we think we need to approach for those transplant eligible newly myeloma patients. And you go first, I go second.
Sure. This goes along with my particular area of interest. I certainly do think that identifying these high-risk patients and figuring out a way to improve their outcomes is a very big area of unmet need in this space. And because these are the patients who have not quite benefited nearly as much from all of the advancements that we have made in multiple myeloma. And I think, you know, that we have many tools to identify these patients. FISH actually does a pretty good job of that. We'll see whether our tools to do that improve so that we can deliver these new therapies to the patients who really need it, and also potentially continue to have the benefits that are there for patients who are likely to do well for a long period of time. There are so many other unmet, needs that we have in this space. I think that as we're trying to move, treatments earlier into lines of therapy, particularly things like bispecifics and CAR T, I think that improving access is another really important unmet need that we as a field and as a community need to address. And I think that these must kind of go on, together as we try to move things forward. And
I totally agree with you, Tim. I think being able to identify those patients early before there's a treatment failure and be able to intervene then on a different approach now that we have other tools, right? Because up to now, we're bringing everything up front and we still cannot do it. Now, hopefully with those innovative immunotherapies, we have a shot of trying to improve the outcome for those patients. And I think my insight is on the other end of the spectrum, perhaps, is the patients who we are the majority who don't have ultra-high risk disease, who are likely to do very well. And as we discussed, our therapies have been developed to as a fixed package, right, that you give to everybody without any particular adjustment. And I think we now have enough success on most patients up front that we need to further define and carve out a pathway where patients can be free of therapy. When you talk to patients, they clearly identify that as a desirable area for us to work on. And I like to quote my friend, Dr. Henrietta Christensen from Seed of Hope. She says, stopping therapy is an unmet need in myeloma, and I fully heartily agree with that. So thank you very much, Dr. Smith. This has been an extremely informative and insightful discussion, and thank for our audience for watching this Cancer Network program on newly diagnosed multiple myeloma. We hope you found this discussion to be useful and informative to your practice. Thank you so much.
Don't forget to subscribe to the Oncology On The Go podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or anywhere podcasts are available, or listen online at cancernetwork.com/resources/podcasts. The Oncology On The Go podcast is the official podcast of cancernetwork.com, the home of the journal Oncology. For more information, visit us at cancernetwork.com and find us on Twitter at cancernetwork without the O, or on Facebook and LinkedIn at cancer-network.